Welcome to the LarryNFishers.com podcast. I'm Larry Lannon. You won't hear the usual musical bit on this one. I've had a bit of an equipment failure, but hopefully that will be fixed in the next few days. It was my honor to invite Todd Houston, the member of the House of Representatives for the state of Indiana, representing fishers. I spoke to Todd Houston during the afternoon of Monday, December 31st. About the Fishers Public Library, the Hamilton East Library System here in the municipal complex in downtown Fishers. Just the last few months, the Ignite space has been opened up, but it's a haven for artists, 3D printers. I am recording this in the television studio, which has amazing acoustics, which is why I always try to reserve this for podcast recording. So don't hesitate to come to the Hamilton East Library at Fishers. Ask for a tour of the Ignite space. The staff will be more than happy to do that. It's my honor to have Todd Houston from the Fishers area, member for us at the Indiana General Assembly House of Representatives. Todd, welcome. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Wow, I just looked at your 7-question survey you mailed out to your constituents, but I was a little surprised that education was not part of that. The reason I mention that is that teachers in the state are really getting pretty adamant they need a pay raise. And with the changes that have been made in financing schools when Mitch Daniels was the governor, a lot of the money that's used to pay teachers is authorized by the General Assembly. It's really your decision rather than the local school boards. Of course, they have the final say, but as a result of that, Speaker Bosma has said that teacher raises are very high on his priority, but the governor has said he's not sure there's going to be enough money. Now, you are now co-chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. You'll be dealing with this issue. How do you approach this issue as the session begins?
Well, first of all, Larry, I think we provide per pupil funding, roughly about, on average, $7,000, a little more $7,000. There's a million kids in the state of Indiana. We invest, it'll be north of about $7.1 billion this year in education spending. But at the end of the day, we don't control teacher raises. Local school boards do. And, you know, I was a former school board member at Hamilton Southeastern. I think it's the most appropriate place where they should control it, because they control the variables that make up where teacher raises come from. We don't control the number of teachers that they have or the administrative aides that they have. And I think each school and each the administration and teachers should come together and figure that out. Obviously, if you want to have more teachers and more administrative aides, you're going to have, it's going to impact the amount of teacher salary. So, we will continue to make significant investments in education. It's more than half the state budget goes into K-12 education. We will continue to do that. We look forward to making those investments this year. But at the end of the day, and we're going to look for ways that we can measure how much money is actually getting in the teachers' pockets. There's a lot of statistics out there. Different people can point to different statistics. And there are places that I think have addressed the teacher pay issue across the state. There are some places that really lag behind, and we need to have a better job. But we have to have a better idea on where those places are and make it a little more transparent. But at the end of the day, I think we own the responsibility to invest. But I think the locals actually own how they determine how teachers are paid.
Right. And do you have a lot of data? I mean, I've seen this argument before from members of the General Assembly and their staff and the study committees that perhaps local school boards are not investing as much in their teachers as they could be. Yeah. What exactly do you know about that as a lawmaker, and what are your studies?
Not as much as you would like. Yeah. And again, I think it's different from district to district. I 2 years ago we passed some changes in school accounting. I think are going to be very advantageous to really understand how those dollars are being spent and where they're being spent. And so we'll have a better idea. Ironically, starting this coming calendar year. So we'll have a better idea as we look in future years about how those dollars are being spent. I also think we have to be conscientious to the fact that some schools are doing are way ahead of and recognize those schools that are really making the investments in classroom teachers. And there could be a, you know, as a school district like ours, you know, our community stepped up and said, you know, it's our, we believe we want smaller class sizes. We want to compensate our teachers better. And so we passed a referendum to do that. But we made that choice. We made the choice of saying we want smaller class sizes. We want different types of programming. I'm not sure that's always a state's responsibility. And we've seen school districts across the state that are very small pass referendums so they could stay open. And for that, I say good for them. We've seen others that have not. And I'm not sure it's the state's interest to decide for local communities what they should and shouldn't be doing. They should or shouldn't be doing. Over 50% of the state general fund budget, over $7 million, over $7,000 a kid. On average, goes out and to the schools. A few years ago, we changed the fund kids and not school districts. I think that's the right decision. We'll continue to do that. But it puts more responsibility on local school boards and local communities. And I think that's the appropriate place for the discussion to take place.
Yeah, I've covered two referenda since I've been covering HSC schools, and both of them passed with large margins, 60-70% yes. But there's been kind of a mixed record of referenda around the state. Yeah. Some locals have not done that. So what I'm hearing you say is it's really up to the local people sometimes to get more money into their teachers' pockets or to add teachers.
If they believe that that's an important thing in their community, yeah. I mean, I believe the number 68% of general fund referendums have passed, over two-thirds. So the fact of the matter is that people, when they made a compelling case of their communities to support it, and I think that's the appropriate place for those type of decisions to be made. Again, I think, one thing I'm conscientious of is I don't want to sit downtown and think I can make decisions for 292 school districts across the state of Indiana who have a variety of different needs, a variety of different types of situations that they're dealing with. And so, we have to provide, again, a good investment. But at the end of the day, local schools need to actually, determine how they want those dollars to be spent. And again, sometimes they may go into different things than other communities would have supported, but it may be with the right instance for that individual community.
And there's one other aspect of the education issue I want to talk about before we go on to other things. Indiana State University did a study this past year. I thought the results were pretty shocking to me. It was a study of school superintendents, and the upshot of that is that the teacher shortage is getting much worse, maybe worse in some place than others. But it, as a whole, even Dr. Mike Beresford, before he left for Carmel, told me 2 years ago that he was beginning to feel the effects of the teacher shortage. Fewer people going into teaching, people leaving teaching at a much younger age to go into some other type of profession because of less pressure, more money, those sorts of things. And HSC schools are doing okay in filling their positions, but that study showed that, there had been a number of years where getting a science or a math teacher might be difficult. Some of these rural districts are saying, we can't find social studies teachers, which is a new sort of thing. So I guess my question to you is, when you see data like that and you hear superintendents telling you stories like that, what is the legislature's role to deal with that issue?
Well, I think you have to break down that issue in a couple different ways. One is that there are certain communities in our rural areas that are struggling, frankly, to find not just teachers but doctors and pharmacists and nurses and other key professions too. And so I think that's a broader discussion, Larry, than just teachers, candidly. The other areas in math and sciences, look, I mean, it's been a tremendous challenge. I think it's a challenge everywhere, not just in rural Indiana, but in suburban Indiana and in urban Indiana and across the country, actually. And we try to give districts tools to be able to attract people into those types of differentiated pay because different ways to compensate, understanding that those people have a variety of options they can pursue, both in the public and the private sector. And I think, you know, we've always tried to treat everything as the same. And I think, you know, we have to realize that, right now, I mean, this statistic's a little old, but there were a few years ago where I think there were only seven, high school science teachers that graduated from any higher ed institutions with a teaching certificate, I should know. And again, that statistic is a little old. That may have changed. But I mean, we're going to have to find ways to attract people in. I think the other thing we have to, continually be thinking about is the fact that the expectation that and I'm always a little baffled about why we expect teachers to stay in their same profession for 30 years when, frankly, most young people don't anymore. I think the one of the statistics I saw recently was, the average 30-year-old's been in four different jobs. I mean, I think there's an exploring. There's just a different way. It's not the path that so many people take. So we have to continue to create a pipeline in higher education to fill these teaching jobs. But look, I mean, there are shortage areas that I think we're trying to address, particularly in the STEM-based subjects, science, technology, engineering, math. In the rural areas, I know those communities are very, very aggressively trying to think of new and better ways to attract teachers.
I did some volunteer work at HSC High School recent years, and I met a man who was a corporate executive. He'd retired. He was in his late 50s. He was taking the proper training. He wanted to become a teacher in his later years. I lost track of him. I really wish I knew where he had gone with that. But is that a possible untapped source for teaching?
Sure. And we've tried to do a lot of things to provide licensure flexibility and to find, alternative certifications for teachers or for professionals who like to come into teaching. I've been, frankly, an advocate and a champion of that, always believing at the end of the day the local principal and the local superintendent will determine if that person is a high-quality teacher. And we create a whole bunch of process to get somebody in the classroom. And I know a lot of that's valuable. I don't want to be dismissive of it. But there's also that process of having a trust in a local superintendent and having a trust in a local principal to say, I think that individual could come in and help my kids today. I think can be advantageous to my kid, and we should be doing everything we can to give them the flexibility to make that happen.
We'll move on to another subject. The survey that you sent out did kind of touch on economic development, a couple of different issues. Should it be, should you attract people? Should you try to grow your own businesses? And Fishers has certainly tried to do both. Where we're sitting now was the first home for launch Fishers, which has since moved into bigger quarters. So how local communities handle economic development, the state really does set the parameters for that, the legal parameters, the systems. And one particular tool that Fishers uses quite often, as well as abatement and that kind of thing, and waiving of fees, would be tax increment financing, what's called TIF. And it's very complicated, but to sum it up as quickly as I can, is basically using property tax money that would normally go to the local community to basically pay for that project.
The other taxing units.
Yes, units as well, all the taxing units. Thanks for correcting me on that. So the property tax money is used to pay for the project over a number of years. It could be 20, 25 years. My question to you is, do you think that the state should leave these laws alone and see how they're working, or do you think that there could be some study and look into how some of these economic development programs, such as TIF, might be improved, changed? What's your view on that?
I think, again, in most instances, TIF is used properly. It's always dangerous, I think, to try and legislate based upon probably some inappropriate actions. I think it's important to recognize, this is why I made that comment, that TIF dollars are not just the loss of capture of incremental growth for that individual municipality, but also for all the other taxing units. So that's something that I think the community needs to be aware of and consider. I think in most instances, TIF has been used positively. I don't see major changes. I get concerned when we've seen TIF programs be used as for things that I think are outside the normal bounds of economic development. And we've seen that in a handful of places across the state. You know, the biggest thing, we again, this goes back to not thinking that we know best for what's happening in 92 counties and thousands of communities plus, 1,000-plus communities in our state too. We need to create some parameters. We need to make sure that we support those local communities as they do economic development. My only – and I've said this before, I'll say this again. My only concern about TIFs are you really increasing growth, or are you just moving somebody down the street? And if you're just moving somebody down the street, that's not a whole big level of economic impact. And Larry, it's different in Fishers, and I think – and I had the privilege of growing up here, so I've got to see how Fishers has changed. But, you know, the biggest thing for economic development is rooftops. I mean, you know, and what's given us such a great opportunity in Fishers to do a lot of great – and Mayor Fadness and his crew, a lot of great work has been that we had a lot of rooftops here, and businesses want to come. They knew there were workers and those types of things. So we can be smart and creative on economic development. But if you're just moving retail from one community down the street to your community, I think you have to question, is that a very good economic investment? I hate to question that from the state, because that would presume I know. But I hope more communities think about that, and particularly their TIFing of retail is very, very important, because the retail market is changing so dramatically that, you know, you could do a big retail TIF that really feels good right now that in 10 years doesn't feel very good at all. And with the change of assessment and all the different changes in the retail space, it can be problematic. So it's something we're paying close attention to. I'm not sure it's something we'll take a very aggressive approach to this session.
So you feel Fishers has done a good job of utilizing TIF?
I think I've not heard from other taxing units that it's been a big deal. I think the mayor and his team have done I think a good job in economic development as a whole. As I always say to the mayor and Superintendent Boroff, you know, they in the school, my friends on the school board and the city council, you know, they've got a lot more information to make those types of decisions than I do. I trust that they're making the right ones. And I think particularly the mayor understands that the change in the marketplace means that, you know, you have to be careful on how you use TIF moving forward.
And it should be noted, referendums that are voted in are exceptions to the TIF.
That's right. They're outside. Yeah. They're outside the TIF. So, you know, there are different advantages. The other thing I would say is I have not heard a lot of pushback from our existing business community regarding the use of TIFs. And, they would be ones I would suspect because they are, frankly are. I was just going to mention that. They are outside of the caps. Those referendums are. So the existing local business owners are paying those.
I do have to ask about a couple of tough subjects that have come up in the last year. The first one has to do with Attorney General Curtis Hill. The governor, Speaker Bosma, other state leaders have asked him to resign. He has not done that. I guess the question to you is, as an individual legislator, do you think that Attorney General Hill should resign?
I would prefer if he did. I just think that right now it's a distraction, and it's not good for us from a legislative body or for the Attorney General, most importantly, the people we serve. It's going to be quite a distraction. So I wish he would resign. That being said, I understand that he doesn't have a desire to do it. And that probably won't happen.
The only alternative that state lawmakers have or state government has is an impeachment process. So far, nobody in the Republican Party has spoken in favor of that, saying it would be a big distraction to other issues. How would you feel?
I would kind of align with that. I think when you look at a budget session and you look at everything else going on, I think that would be a big distraction. I'm troubled by the report. I read the report. I'm troubled by the behavior. Hopefully it ceased immediately and certainly doesn't happen moving forward. I just think that would turn into such a distraction that a lot of other things that are important would be lost in the shuffle.
Should the Attorney General's office be appointed rather than elected, do you think?
You know, I've always felt that way. I've always felt that both the state superintendent and which is now set to become appointed in 2024, and the Attorney General should both be appointed. I understand people have differences of opinions on that, but I've always just felt like those two, they're not outlined specifically in our Constitution, and I think it would probably be for the betterment. But I recognize I have friends on the other side who believe passionately that's important that be an elected position too.
I have to ask one other thing, and it has to do with Speaker Boswell. This came out in the last year or so. The Indianapolis Star had a story basically dealing with Speaker Boswell using campaign funds for a private investigation for an accuser of an incident that was alleged many, many years ago. So far, most state lawmakers have gotten behind Speaker Boswell. But I guess my question to you isn't so much that, but do you think it was a mistake for Speaker Boswell to use campaign funds for an investigation, a private investigation such as that?
You know, Larry, I don't, because first of all, I think the speaker was trying to defend his name and his reputation. And quite honestly, the story would never have taken place if he wasn't in elected office. So I think being in elective office, made it the story that it was. And so he used his campaign funds, which my understanding was his totally appropriate use to at least, try and defend himself to the accusation. So I felt comfortable with it. And I think it feels like it was probably, it was legally appropriate and appropriate to try and defend, your reputation and name.
Okay. Moving on to something else, this has to do with your committee assignments. You had three committees. Now you're on Ways and Means as a co-chair. Is it a co-chair or vice chair?
Yes, co-chair.
Co-chair, which is a big job.
Yeah.
All the money legislation goes through Ways and Means. And it is a budget session. I hate to say this, but, people who are in the legislature, who cover the legislature, like to use the word biennium. And most people don't know what biennium is. It's just a two-year budget.
Exactly.
That's what it means.
That's right.
And that's how Indiana budgets on a two-year basis. And for the fiscal year beginning July 1 of 19. We're recording this on the last day of 2018. So I guess I would ask you, as you look at what Ways and Means that you've been on as a member of the committee, now you're a co-chair, what's going to go through that committee that's going to get a great deal of scrutiny from you?
Sure. It always begins and first and foremost with a budget where, you're making all the significant investments for the state. And obviously that deals with K-12, higher education. Obviously Medicare is a huge component, all the other government agencies. So that's in all the local taxation and state taxation issues. So for me, that's always going to be it'll be the biggest focus of the session. The other thing, we'll be looking at what we refer to as the dollars to the classroom, that type of legislation that ensures that dollars actually get spent on classroom teachers or it will be a predominant focus. I stepped off the other committees just because of the amount of time it takes. The chair, Ways and Means, my co-chair is one of my favorite people on earth, Tim Brown, and Tim was a really terrible motorcycle accident this fall. It's like watching God do a miracle in front of your eyes. It's incredible recovery, and it's been awesome to see.
Is he going to be ready to
he's going to be actively involved.
Okay.
And, he's still making a recovery. Physically, it's a long way, but Tim is just – he's an amazing human being, somebody I love dearly. And so, supporting Tim and working through the budget wears everybody out. By the time you get to late April, you're pretty fatigued. And, I always kid that, you learn to say no. I think people think you go into politics to say yes. You don't like to please people. Unfortunately, when you deal with the budget, there are a lot of really good ideas and people that really want to do good things. And there's just not always enough money to go around. And so you learn how to say no. So looking forward to the opportunity. I've worked closely with Tim in the past two budget cycles. So just a little bit different of a role, and then we'll hopefully get something good passed by the end of April.
Well, the governor has said this is going to be a tight budget year. I'm trying to think back. When have you been flush with cash?
There's never a year you're flush with cash. In 2000 and 13 and 15, you know, it was tight. 17 was, you know, it's all, like you said, Larry, it's always tight. 15, I know we really made a big investment in education in 15, K-12. And 17, obviously, was a very unique year where we did the budget and the roads bill, the infrastructure bill. So that was challenging. You know what makes this year very unique is revenue-wise, you know, the Indiana economy is doing great. And we're seeing really good revenue increases. And normally that would potentially give you a little more breathing room. This year, you know, the increase in the Department of Child Care, Department of Child Services, will be $286 million, which will probably be, you know, two-thirds or three-quarters of all the new money that would get spent. So it really tightens up every other area. And unfortunately, there's a variety of reasons that, that cause that huge amount of new money. But that's what makes this year so much challenging. If we didn't have if it was like a normal year where agency budgets were about where they normally be, it'd kind of be a year where we could do some, I think, some unique things. But the challenge with the Department of Child Services just makes it a year where, particularly in the first year, like you said, the two-year budget, it's going to be very, very, very tight.
And talk more about this, because the Department of Child Services has been in the news for a number of years. I know that there are a lot of people that are trying to explain why the funding has to be increased for that. I know that a lot has been said. We talked about teachers, you know, the caseworkers there, the pay, the turnover, the difficulty in dealing with these very hard issues where families and children need to be protected when there are family crises. So explain why so much money will need to be invested in Child Protective Service.
You know, I think there's a variety of different reasons. One is because of the opioid crisis, we just saw a huge spike in the number of cases. Two, Indiana was honestly more aggressive than most other any other state in taking children out of the home. And when you do that, that drives up your costs. And three, we needed to make an investment in those very workers that you're talking about, Larry. And I will say this, that Denise and I have done foster care. We've worked with the Department of Child Services. We worked with those case managers. I simply don't know if there could be a more difficult or challenging job. My respect for them is through the roof. And I think, you know, the challenge that they deal with on a day-to-day basis is surreal. And so, you know, we're trying to do everything we can to both increase pay, but also reduce caseloads, because I have such admiration for those folks. These kids are the most vulnerable kids in society, and we own a responsibility to make sure that they have every opportunity or place in the best environment for them. So that's what we'll continue to focus on.
I do believe that foster parents are the unsung heroes of that whole system, and have a great deal of respect for you and others who have done that. Let's move on to another issue. Hate crime legislation. This is one that's in the news, and it's one of the reasons it is, and I think I'm right on this. Indiana, I believe, is one of only five states not to have such a statute on the books, and it's been controversial. But what I've been hearing lately, and I'm sure you've heard it too, obviously, is that the business community is beginning to say that this is hurting Indiana as a national as our national reputation, because we are one of the few states that has not gone into this. And one of the most controversial parts of any hate crimes legislation will be the details. For instance, should gender identity be a part of that is one of the big questions. So what are your views going into the session on potential for hate crimes legislation?
I think the governor said that he feels like it has an economic impact. So, this is one of those where, quite honestly, I'm like so many people, I'd like to see us get off the list. I think we have to first determine who owns the list and what it actually does take. We've got some things that you can actually increase sentencing based – judges currently today have the ability to increase sentencing based upon the motivation of the crime. So I think, you know, we need to continue to figure out what's appropriate. There's a lot of different – pieces of legislation I know floating around. I've heard the Senate's got, you know, I think the Senate's already filed a couple bills about it. I would suspect we'll have, I know a good friend of mine, a colleague of mine, Tony Cook's already said he's going to do a bill on this. So to be honest with you, Larry, I haven't read any of those bills yet, just simply because I've been dealing with all the budget stuff, and when it gets there, I'll make sure I take a look. You know, I'm like everybody else. I like to get off the list. I know it's an issue that, again, Governor Holcomb feels very positive, very strongly about, and one I think would be best if we were to put behind us.
One issue that has been getting a lot of attention around the country in various states is redistricting reform, to depoliticize that system. Yeah. So whichever party's in charge has less control, it's more of a neutral system as much as can be done. What are your views about redistricting reform?
You know, I've supported – we've passed out of the House multiple times a House redistricting bill, a redistricting reform bill. You know, this is one of those that it's complicated. I'm always struck by it's never as easy, and I don't know how you depoliticize it. I know, you know, people often talk about Iowa and other states, and I'm familiar with what they've done. We'll see what we get done this year. It's a process where I think people want it to be easier than it is, Larry. I mean, you know, what I always say is like, you know, you can break up community of interest. I always say I have the best district in the state of Indiana. I have one mayor, one city, one school board. And hopefully if you ask the mayor or the schools, they've said I've represented them well. I'm not sure that if I have three other districts does that make me a more effective legislator if I go down and have different types of communities? Matter of fact, I love the fact we have a very diverse community as we speak today. So I'm not sure. I always think that, you know, hey, what we need to do is create this, you know, convoluted system in which, you know, you have – you know, you try and balance out a whole series of things because you're going to lose something in that process too. So I think we'll continue to take a look at it and see what happens.
When I studied political science in college, my first class we took, we did an exercise on redistricting. This was the 70s, yeah. And trying to district in a way that would satisfy a federal court. And we didn't have computers at that time. Now the computerization has really changed how that's done, but it was done by hand in those days, and it was
and Indiana maps were when done were very well regarded. Mm-hmm. You know, people look at the changes in the state, and I think I there was a unbelievable number statistic recently about the number of county commissioners that are Republican or Democrat. I think, you know, people look at the lopsided, you know, supermajorities and think that there's something amiss, but I would tell you that I think there's been a whole series of factors that we went from a very competitive landscape in 2000 and you know, 8-10 to supermajorities a few years later. And look, I think pendulums swing and you know, and that's I think there's this like this myopic at times focus on redistricting, I think, doesn't also take a look at some changes that have also taken place.
Speaking of the U.S. Supreme Court, I mentioned a moment ago, that court handed down a decision just a few months ago, basically leaving it up to the states as to whether you want to have sports gambling or not sports betting. This is only allowed in Las Vegas and I think a couple other places before that ruling. Now it's up to the states. Most states are looking at this and thinking, wow, there's some tax money there if you want to go there. What's your view on that?
I think if you're going to go there, don't do it for tax money. It's not very much. I mean, you know, on a $14 billion budget, you're talking about $15 million.
So in general, is it a good idea?
I think that's where, you know, it should begin. And you know, look, I've been supportive of it in the past. I'll be supportive of it in the future. You know, I think there's an opportunity to you know, it helps the existing marketplace. It also brings stuff that's frankly outside of the law and the illegal status. So I think overall it probably makes a lot of sense. You're seeing most states, you know, I would guess by the time you're done with most legislative sessions this year, you're going to see most states have it. So my suspicion will be we'll probably, you know, move forward in some way, shape, or form. But you never know in a session, and gaming issues are challenging issues in and of itself. I think I would tend to be one of those that would probably support it.
Well, one last gaming issue that still the legislature will deal with either this year or in the future is that there's one license in Gary that is likely to move somewhere else. I know Terre Haute is making a big pitch for it, and some people want it in central Indiana, although I doubt that'll happen. So I'm just curious as to your feelings on moving that Gary license and where you think it might best be moved.
That's got a whole series, you know, that's a very interesting set of circumstances. I know that that involve doing multiple things. First of all, doing right by Gary and doing right by the state of Indiana. I know there are other people who made investments in Indiana are very concerned about if that license were to move. I think that will be an interesting topic for this year. I don't know how it will all play out. I think, anytime, like I said, anytime you face a gaming issue in Indiana, whether controversial or not, it becomes very challenging. And this is one that will probably be an interesting one to watch because there's a lot of discussions. I have friends in Terre Haute, representatives in Terre Haute. They're anxious and hopeful there. I've read some of the comments in the paper about going other places. We'll see what – we'll kind of see in the next couple months, I think – how it begins to take shape. And as it takes shape, we have to look at going back. And I was quick to say about the biggest thing about gaming, I think I just want to always make sure that we think about is tax revenues. You know, used to be, Larry, we were the third largest gaming state in the country. I don't think most people realize that.
I think we're fourth now, are we not?
I think we're
something like that.
Yeah, but we were, right behind, but we were behind Nevada, New Jersey, obviously because of Las Vegas and Atlantic City, and then Indiana. And obviously those have changed. And the percentage of gaming revenue, the percentage of our state budget comes from gaming revenues has dropped significantly. The percentage has dropped. So I think, I just want to make sure we make gaming policy based on it being the right public policy and not the chasing of dollars. And I think what happens at times is people say, you could make X number of millions of dollars more if you do sports betting or if you open a casino here, you open a casino there. And I just want to make sure, look, when you get into $14 billion, budgets and those types of things, at the end of the day, you're making the decision based upon the right public policy, because the public policy will stand long after what happens to those revenues or not.
Yeah, and other states have gotten into it, so that's made a difference.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Ohio's into it. Illinois's into it. Michigan. So, look, we face a different level of competition we've ever faced before. And again, that's holistically, I just mentioned I want to make the right public policy. We also have to recognize that these are key in many communities in our state, the largest employer. And so we have to be respectful of understanding that that's an industry that we want to continue to be strong. And if you're sitting in Rising Sun, Indiana, if you're sitting in Hammond, Indiana, if you're sitting in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, Cordon, Indiana, these are big deals. And I mean, we want those industries to be strong. I just want to make sure we make decisions based upon the comprehensive nature, not just short term, we got a budget problem, let's fill a quick hole.
So. Anything else coming up at the legislature you'd like to your constituents know about before we go?
No, we'll continue to, I think, I'll continue to make a look out for. I'm working with one of the issues I know Mayor Fadness has talked a lot about and others is how do you support a more regional concept of local economic development, recognizing that you know, Fishers is only as strong as Indianapolis and the communities that surround us. And how do we make sure we support local communities working together to meet the infrastructure and project needs that I think, you know, are don't stop at 96th Street, that don't stop at some artificial barrier that says that's a different city or that's a different town. So we'll continue to work with the mayor and members of the Fishers community on that. We're blessed to have a terrific Chamber of Commerce and truly a tremendous school district, both from the administration to the teachers. Larry, as you know, one of my favorite people on earth is Jan Chandler, yes. Who's the head of the Teachers Association, Ham Southeastern Education Association here in Fisher. So I never lack for good counsel, and I'm very grateful and appreciative of it.
Todd Houston is the state representative for the Fishers area. Todd, thank you so much for joining me today.
Appreciate it, Larry. Thank you.
My thanks to Todd Houston, who was willing to take time out just before the beginning of the legislative session to give us a preview of what he expects to happen. So we'll be watching it closely, and we again thank Representative Houston for his time. This is the Larry in Fishers podcast. My name is Larry Lannon. I write the LarryInFishers.com local news blog from Fishers, Indiana, a suburban community northeast of Indianapolis. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again.